We're talking with Thomas Simmons here, who is a Libertarian candidate for the U.S. House District 1 in Massachusetts. He's going to be on the ballot November 8th, 2016. And again, his website is Simmons, S-I-M-M-O-N-S, the number 4, congress.com. And Thomas, thank you for joining us today. And, you know, being here for our audience to know that there are other options, at least in District 1 in Massachusetts, and we've interviewed about 25 people so far across the country, and you're someone giving your district another choice besides a Republican or Democrats. And so welcome, and how come you're not running as a Republican or Democrat, and you're running as a Libertarian, and why did you decide to run this year?
Well, first, let me thank you. I think this is a great service that you're providing, especially for those of us who are running as third-party candidates, because it's often hard for us to break through the mainstream media and get our opinions and get our voices out there and let people know there actually is a choice. I chose to run as a Libertarian largely because I have major differences of opinion with both the Republican and the Democratic parties, and I didn't feel comfortable throwing in with one of them simply so I could have a major party designation next to my name. I generally believe that government ought to be out of your bedroom, out of your wallet, out of your backyard, out of your business, and I find myself much more in tune with Libertarian Party than either the Reps or the Dems. So that's why I chose the Libertarian Party. I chose this year because there's a groundswell of dissatisfaction with both of those parties, and I'm also retiring after teaching for 19 years at the community college level, and it just seemed like the right time and the next step to take in my life.
Yeah, and on your website here, Simmons, the number 4, congress.com, if there was ever a year for credible and capable fresh blood to represent Western Massachusetts in the U.S. Congress, 2016 is it. And
This is it.
And it has a little bit of your bio here. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Sure. This is a year, first of all, this is a year where the presidential candidates, the major party presidential candidates, have the least level of support by the American people. We have more people who are independents. And then on a local level where I'm running against someone who's been a career politician who's been in the same office for 27 years, usually without any opposition whatsoever. And he's a Democrat, and even people in his own party are tired of his inattention to the district and tired of his assuming that he is just the heir apparent to the district every year. So, as I said, this is definitely the year. By way of background, I've been a community college teacher for the last 19 years, teaching economics and business at Greenfield Community College. I'm also a founding faculty advisory member of the Grinspoon Entrepreneurship Initiative, which is a private foundation in Western Mass that helps college students start their businesses, helps them with business plans, helps them with seed capital, and I've been working with hundreds of students over the last two decades to help them get new businesses started and up and running, some very successful. Wow. I'm also a member of the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary. I'm solely responsible at this point for making sure the navigational channels on the Connecticut River in Western Mass are clear and free from obstruction so that we have safe navigation for boaters going up and down the river. I'm past union president where I work. I've served on the Town Conservation Commission in my hometown of Shelburne, and I've served in the board of directors of two different HIV service agencies. So for me, it's not a case of someone just saying, hey, I'll throw my name into the ring and see what happens. I've been involved for the last several decades in my community and in my region, and I think I offer a credible alternative to the major party candidate.
Yeah, so, I mean, I just heard your bio there, and people can read it. You actually, there's more in there than what you just said, but and a very, a credible candidate compared to someone who, has pretty much been in Washington their entire career. And so that's one thing I have noticed. A lot of these third options, independent candidates do have a lot of incredible life experience. And, you know, so I guess people are going to have to decide who's the best choice. Have you had any debates yet? Are you going to have any debates or more debates in the future with the...
I would love to have a debate with my opponent. I've called our local TV stations and I've requested that they try and set something up. Some of the local newspapers have criticized my opponent for not being in the district and not being around, and have called him to account and said you need to show up and you need to debate this candidate. He has ignored me completely so far. And I've been out in the district for months at this point. I have a very large district. There's 85 towns in this district. It's the largest one in Massachusetts. It's the entire western third of Massachusetts. I've been at town-sponsored meet and greets, library meet and greets, county fairs, senior citizens groups, gay groups, labor dinners, you name it. And he never shows up.
Wow. It, you know what kind of, I wonder what would make him show up. I mean, you know, he obviously probably feels it's safer not to have a debate, and that's, you know, questionable. But it kind of reminds me of like a Rocky movie or something, like someone wanting to challenge, you know, the person who has the heavyweight belt. And if someone keeps challenging them, and if he refuses to, you know, go in the ring, then by default, you know, in a way, at least of public opinion, the person who refuses to defend their title loses. And so maybe, I don't know, there's some kind of analogy.
And that is
there.
That is beginning to happen because, as I said, I've been in a lot of these small towns, and I've spoken to a lot of town officials who are normally faithful Democrats, and they're disgusted with him. And they asked me the same question you asked me. Is he going to debate you? Is he going to show up? Is he going to, you know, tangle with you? And my answer, unfortunately, is based on everything I've seen so far, no, he's avoiding me. And they just roll their eyes and say, yeah, that's pretty typical. We don't see him either.
Let me ask you this. How many debates would you be willing to have? What do you think would be, with this amount of time left, 40, 41 days, 42 days remaining, how many debates do you think ideally there should be from now? Let's forget about the past. There probably should have already been two or three debates, but how many debates do you think ideally, realistically, there should be in the remaining 40?
I can see two or three debates that I could have with him if they were shown on the local TV stations and written up in the local newspapers. We could spend one entire debate just on social and domestic issues, one entire debate on foreign affairs, foreign trade, international issues, and then probably one entire debate just on local issues. We have a number of very specific local issues and attempt to build a pipeline, Trans-Canada pipeline through western Massachusetts. We have a watershed that's in danger of contamination because of a toxic spill. So there's a lot of local issues as well that are just very specific to my district. So I'd say a good three debates would be appropriate.
And let me ask you, I don't want to ask you to pledge anything, but let's just say you were elected in 2016, November 8th, and 2 years from now, you know, you have someone wanting to challenge you, wanting you to be in the debates. Can you promise to be in the, you know, to give them the opportunity to have debates like you want to be in the debates this year?
I'll take it even one step further. Not only will I agree to that right now, flat out, I also intend on having a series of town meetings within this district throughout the year on a regular basis, perhaps once a month the entire time I'm in Congress, so that I'm in touch with the people of the district.
Well, that sounds really good. Now, let me ask you this. What is and actually, since you brought it up, that I'd never heard of that, you know, Canada, Massachusetts. Can you explain that? And what's your position on that?
Oh, well, like many places in the country, you know, many people have heard of the Keystone Pipeline, and there's been a controversy in North Dakota with the Dakota Pipeline right now. We've got, you know, a similar issue where a number of different companies have been interested in building a new natural gas pipeline through western Massachusetts in order to bring natural gas to Boston. And for those of your listeners who are not residents of Massachusetts, Boston is not the entire state. There's a whole bunch of us who live in the hills and the woods way in western Massachusetts on the Vermont border, and that's where my district is, and that's where they want to put this through. For me as a libertarian, it's a very, very easy issue, and that is the pipeline cannot be built without the use of eminent domain to take private land. And as far as I'm concerned, eminent domain to take private property, to give it for the use of a private company who will make a private profit off of that, is absolutely unacceptable. It's a no-go from the start.
All right, and I could totally hear that position, and so that sounds pretty clear. And actually, I do want to ask you your issues here. Just go through them pretty quickly here. All right, so we'll start with this is on your website under the solutions section. What about civil liberties? You did write about civil liberties. Are you a civil libertarian? How are you going to take seriously your pledge to defend and protect the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, et cetera?
I am a very – first of all, a little bit of background I did not give you. I'm an attorney. I graduated from Hofstra Law, the same Hofstra that the debate was at the other night. Back in 1984, and I am an absolutist on the Bill of Rights, and that means the freedom of speech, period, not free speech zones and not free speech only if we agree with you or only if we think it's not dangerous. It means freedom of assembly without getting a permit and getting approval beforehand. It means your Second Amendment rights. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. It means no warrantless search and seizure. It means a Fifth Amendment right to refuse to answer to authority, even without saying, I'm asserting my Fifth Amendment right. You have that right. And every single one of these rights has been chipped away at, has been peeled away at by the right and the left. Starting with the Patriot Act and government surveillance over telephone calls and library records to Supreme Court decisions that have given the police broader powers to investigate and search without a warrant, without real probable cause, to efforts to restrict firearm ownership, to efforts to create free speech zones or outlaw hate speech or decide that press rights are not as free as they ought to be. The whole effort to jail Snowden, who should, as far as I'm concerned, is a hero and not a traitor. Every one of these rights has been chipped away at, always in the name of security. And I value liberty over security.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was the Democrat Senator Russ Feingold who said when they were passing the original Patriot Act is something akin to, you know, we could be totally safe, but then again, we would be living in a fascist society or something like that. And he was one of the few Democrat senators
exactly.
to vote against it. And
I actually like Feingold a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of consensus that could be built, and I'm going to ask you about consensus at the end here. Now, you did have another issue about taxes and wages. Very interesting proposal here. Can you explain that?
Sure. I have a rather unique plan because I think that the Republicans are right on some things but really wrong on others, and I feel the same way about the Democrats. I think the Sanders Democrats have appropriately identified wage disparities in America as being an issue. And actually, both Sanders and Trump have tapped into the discontent with the fact that wages for most Americans have been stagnant for decades. And even though they say the unemployment rate is getting lower, the fact of the matter is at least one in four Americans are now making less than they did just a few years ago because they're cobbling together part-time jobs. And for every unemployed...
They set the bar differently.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry, they set the bar differently. So, yeah,
yes.
What they used to consider... Yeah, they've changed the number. They fudged it around.
If you're working part-time, you're no longer unemployed, period. And for every person, for every man who is unemployed, there are three men who are no longer in the labor force, so they don't count either. So I think the Sanders campaign and to a lesser extent the Trump campaign has put their finger on the problem of wage, lower wages, lower purchasing power, lower disposable income. Where the Democrats get it wrong is the Band-Aid approach of saying, well, let's just raise minimum wage to a livable wage, which, A, usually results in unemployment at entrance-level jobs, B, results in small businesses not having enough funds to expand or pay their other workers, and C, only helps people at the very, very bottom. And there's a lot of people who are above minimum wage who are still working poor and still have stagnant wages. On the right, the answer tends to be, well, let's just eliminate the corporate tax or cut corporate taxes, and that will give corporations the ability to expand and hire and pay more. But the problem has been, objectively, when we've done that in the past, that money, that profit, has not been plowed back into labor. Instead, it ends up going to top executives and goes into the company using that extra freed up cash for gambling in the financial markets. So, with that as the context, and I know it's taken a long time to get out.
All right.
My proposal is I want to cut corporate taxes, but I want to do it in a way that guarantees increased income for labor. And the way I propose to do that is to give a $1.15 direct tax credit right on the tax bill to companies for every $1 they give in profit sharing to all of their employees. The benefit of that is that, A, the company saves money. Instead of paying out $100 million in taxes, they're paying out $85 million in profit sharing, and they just save $15 million. So it does result in more free cash for them, number one. Number two, it guarantees that the money goes into the hands of the labor that actually created the profit in the first place. Number three, it doesn't just affect those who are making minimum wage. It affects everyone in the company, which could create a whole new era of labor management cooperation because now everyone's got a stake in the success of the company. And finally, unlike minimum wage, which is just mandated on all businesses, if your company's not making a profit, if you're just hanging on by a thread, you don't have to do anything more. You're not under a mandate to pay out more as you would be under minimum wage. This actually is a program that has worked in France and Germany. Something like 80% of the large companies in Germany do this, and it was originally instituted as part of a tax reorganization, and now it's simply culturally built into the business sector.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. And so I think people be very interested. I have not heard anything like that. I mean, you say it's implemented in France and Germany. So, I mean, it's already been tested. Very interesting. I'm definitely going to research more into that. And now.
And to give you an example, fortunately, as a teacher, I've had some opportunity to do some research on this as an economics professor. And I've looked at a couple of large companies like Cintas, the uniform company, and Boston Beer, which brews Sam Adams, and Costco, which most of your listeners are probably familiar with, the big warehouse outlet, wholesale outlet. In using their numbers, what they pay in taxes versus what they'd save and what they'd have to pay and how many employees they'd have, each of them would save tens of millions of dollars a year, and every single one of their employees would see an increase in their paycheck of between $7,000 and $9,000 a year from the bottom on up.
So it looks like the employees should be supporting you, and the, you know, the company should be, you should be getting support from all sides on this, and it sounds like a win-win. So, well, let's go to some other issues. You did talk about
Sure.
your district very well there. I feel like I understand that situation more so. You did touch on the national debt and how much we're spending on interest, and that's with an interest rate lower than 1%. I mean, you know, in Jimmy Carter's days, it was like much, much higher. But yes, please explain to us, you know, why
the national debt
is so important.
Sure. Right now, because of years under both Democrats and Republicans of spending more money than we take in, we are $20 trillion in debt. And a lot of Americans, you know, we use the phrase, you know, we just run the printing press. And a lot of Americans don't understand we don't just run a printing press. We actually borrow money from financial institutions to meet the bills that the nation has. So that means that in order to fund this $20 trillion debt, we borrow from Goldman Sachs, from Chase Manhattan, from Lloyd's of London, from Deutsche Bank, from Credit Suisse, from the House of Saud, and then we pay them back with interest. And that interest comes from the individual federal income tax. At this point in our history, that is almost the interest alone, not even paying back the debt, but the interest is almost our third largest expenditure. It's five times more than we spend on roads and bridges. It's three times more than everything we spend on our veterans. It's completely out of control, but no one wants to address it because it means being fiscally responsible. It means having a balanced budget. It means not going back to your district and dangling money before everyone, saying, I'm going to bring you this, and I'm going to bring you that, and I'm going to bring you this, because you've got 435 congressmen who are out there doing that, and that's why we're in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, eventually there's that you know, event horizon where you just go too far, and we don't, you know, we want to stay as far away as that whirlpool as we can. So definitely note taken there. Now, you have here a federal education mandates. Being a teacher, you know, what are some of your personal views on that?
I have, this was actually the issue that launched me into the race. Being a teacher for 19 years, I'm watching students come out of the public schools and then come into college. And in the college I teach at, 60% of those students entering college are not college ready in math and English and need to take remedial courses. So clearly, in the last two decades, something has gone severely wrong in the education system. And when you trace it back, both for No Child Left Behind, which was Bush's creation, and now Common Core, what you find is a common strand running throughout this. And that is there's this sense politicians want to prove to the people that they're doing something. So they say, we're going to have standardized tests, and we're going to test our kids and make sure they're learning, and that'll prove to the world that we're doing something. Well, the problem is, all those standardized tests that are being imposed on kids in the elementary and high school levels are multiple choice. It's not thinking questions. It's not an essay. It's not critical thinking where you draw in history and the arts and mathematics and economics and political science and anthropology and come up with a complicated, rounded answer to a complicated problem. It's what's the answer, A, B, C, or D? And they get to college, and they're in the same frame of mind. You can have a whole complicated discussion on an issue, and a student will say, so what's the answer? Because they've been so trained in, I've got to get the right multiple choice A, B, C, D answer to get the right grade on the test. What's worse is that the schools at both the high school level And now at the college level, in order to receive funding, they need to prove to the state governments that they are making progress. So resources are now being devoted away from teaching and towards report writing. So if you're in education, the customer is no longer the student who needs to learn and acquire skills. The customer is now the state and the federal government, who, because you're proving to them through all sorts of reports and data, and you're hiring people simply to do nothing but write reports, that you're meeting the standards they have come up with. So the entire focus on education is now on showing a politician at the next level above you that you've reached some data point. What's happening to students, on the other hand, is a total crime. So, long way of saying, if I get to Washington, first thing I'm going to try and do is end Common Core and end the entire structure that's been put on the states to engage in standard, a never-ending barrage of standardized testing.
Thomas, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. Actually, I'm sorry. One of my mics got out, but I'm back on here.
Sorry. I was just waxing eloquent, and you fell asleep. I know.
No. Actually, very eloquent. You want to get the students, per se, like you're saying, to be the customer, and enough with the charade of all these tests, which are just going to be forgotten in the pages of history anyways.
Exactly what it is. It's a charade.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. And it sounds like you have a lot. I mean, I honestly think I can see a Green Party person, a Bernie supporter supporting you. I can see a Trump supporter supporting you. I can see independents supporting you. I can see the whole spectrum. You really, sometimes I hear someone on the left or the right, and they can be very divisive. That's not what I'm hearing from you at all. And there are people who do have the ability and to be able to see things in a very much consensus type of a way. And from what I'm hearing, that's kind of what it sounds like. So let me ask you.
Well, I have to tell you, you've pretty much hit the nail on the head in terms of my campaign, because my I'm very open about my campaign strategy. There's no Republican running in this race. So for the 30% or 35% of the district that is Republican, I need to hold them, and I need to show them that we have enough in common that it makes sense for them to vote for me over the incumbent Democrat. However, the district is a very liberal Democratic district, and because I'm a libertarian, I'm actually more liberal than the incumbent Democrat on a number of issues. On a women's right to choose, I'm more liberal than he is. On environmental matters, I'm more liberal than he is. On the war against drugs, I'm more liberal than he is. So if I can hold the Republicans on fiscal issues and actually encourage enough independents and Bernie-crats, if you will, to see that I'm more in line with their thinking than the current incumbent, I've actually put together a coalition that crosses the traditional political boundaries. And that's the entire thrust of my campaign. In fact, I'll tell you very, very quickly, last night I was at two different campaign events. I went to the College Republicans of Western Mass were having a meeting, so I just kind of crashed their party and introduced myself and talked about my platform. And when I left there, I then went to a gay bar and set up a GLBT meet and greet for me later this month. So I'm reaching, across the traditional spectrums.
Well, that's actually, you just addressed that question, because I don't know how exactly I was going to ask it, but that certainly was the answer to it. And so let me ask you this. I've been asking everyone this. It's just kind of a fun question I like to ask people. Could you name some of your favorite people, past or present, elected or not?
Favorite people, past or present, elected or not? Wow. Harriet Tubman, because I always root for the underdog who's kind of breaking the rules but doing the right thing. Thomas Jefferson, eloquent, wonderful. Friedrich Hayek, the economist who wrote The Road to Serfdom.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, who else could I name? Off the top of my head, those three people come right to the top.
Well, no, that sounds great, and I'm sure there's more. And but no, we're just trying to get you know, just off the top of your head there. And Thomas, it has been a pleasure. I'm glad to have talked to you, and it's just exciting interviewing all these people from across the spectrum that are the only third party or independent choice in their specific district who are going to be on the ballot, who deserve to be on the ballot, and who deserves to get the media attention and to be in the debates, etc. So if people want to check you out, again, it's Simmons, the number 4, Congress.com. And Thomas is running as Thomas Simmons here is running as a Libertarian for the U.S. House of Representatives, District number 1 in Massachusetts. And it sounds like he's getting reaching out to people on all sides of the spectrum. His only opponent is one Democrat candidate. And so we're looking forward to him to be on, in the debates, if there's going to be the debates, if the other candidate is even up to it, I guess. But Thomas has promised he'll do as many debates as is needed. And so any final words of wisdom, Thomas? We appreciate your time, sir.
My only words of wisdom are vote your heart. Get out there and vote for the person you agree with, not the person you think is going to win. The only wasted vote is voting for someone you don't agree with.
Sounds good. And people will be able to re-listen to this interview plus the other 25-plus interviews we have so far at libertarianprogressive.com. This will be up there in about 24 hours. And share them. Just say, hey, here's some people that are candidates, and these are some other options that you're not being told about, the truth about the 2016 elections. And well, thank you again for taking the time to enlighten our audience about your campaign, and good luck to your campaign. I hope you have
thank
a nice
evening. Thank you
very
much. Thank you for having me.
All right, you're
okay,
very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take care, sir.
Bye-bye.